It is.
Thank you. All right, so let's just hop right in and maybe just talk about what led to initiate the study.
Okay, so first of all, knowing that in older residents with dementia are often reported as the most challenging and distressing aspect of the disease for the residents and their care partners. I also knew that assisted living residences are the fastest growing residential care option for older adults in the U.S., combined with the fact that close to half residents in those settings have dementia. And a substantial portion of these residents engage in various forms of behavioral expression. Another reason was the lack of studies focusing on quality of care among residents with dementia in assisted living residences. As we know that the vast majority of studies were conducted in nursing homes. Now, my study was a qualitative study, I should say an exploratory qualitative study, and as common in this research method tradition, while the researcher does have a general sense of what he or she intends to examine at the outset of the study, the focus of the study often evolves throughout the study itself. Over 50 years ago, Sofkin and John described the difference between qualitative and quantitative research. Obviously, this is simplification, but by stating that it is as if one is going forth to see what the jungle consists of, rather than making one's way through the jungle to find a particular village. So the former represents qualitative research, and the latter quantitative. So I hope this gives a sense of what made me interested in the study. But do ask me if you need more information about it.
And then how did you figure out which assisted living communities were going to participate in the study? And I'm just questioning, I'm curious, were you turned down by any that you asked?
I wasn't turned down, but the assisted living with which I ended up on they were very interested. They were concerned about the behaviors that occur at the setting. But they also, some of them expressed some concern about, a researcher coming in and investigating, kind of doing a research on expressions. And so I had to, I reassured them that the study, the setting will remain anonymous, and the residents' names will remain anonymous, and all the data will be de-identified and destroyed at the end of the study. And I followed the IRB, the Institutional Review Board, that approved the study from the ethical side before starting it. I should mention that the study was part of a larger study that I conducted at the same assisted living residence, and there are other publications that came out of this study. The goal of the larger study was to identify psychosocial strategies for prevention of various forms of behavioral expressions in residents dementia. Now, I intentionally used the term psychosocial and avoid using the term non-pharmacological strategies because move away from describing person-centered and person-directed approaches using biomedical language. Now, to identify effective strategies, I needed to find a care home that provides a high-quality dementia care. And to do so, I consulted with an expert from the local Alzheimer's Association who recommended me a few residences in the area. Since the primary focus of the study was behavioral expression, I conducted preliminary observation and consulted with the director of the city to confirm that indeed large number of behaviors were manifested by a substantial portion of the residents. I also wanted to focus on a sample of residents with dementia who, on a continual basis, engage in the highest level of negative emotional states and behavioral expression at the assisted living. And to identify these residents, I conducted direct observation and consulted with many staff and managers. And since I were to spend the hour equivalent of a full year at the assisted living, I tried to find a care home that was fairly close to where I lived at the time. This enabled me to arrive, on average, at the assisted living at 7:45 a.m. and leave around 6 p.m. However, I did conduct numerous observations in the later evening hours as well. So I ended up selecting a residence where the managers were very cooperative and collaborating with the study. Now, I would like to give a little bit more background about the study addressing your other questions, if that's okay.
Sure, go ahead.
So first of all, I conducted the study in two dementia units. One was what was called a high cognitive functioning unit, and then residents who are more in the later stages of dementia, which I will call low cognitive functioning units. I focused on 12 residents with dementia. Their average age was 81 years, and it covered all stages of dementia. Two were in the early stage, seven were in the middle stage, and three were in the late stage of dementia. Now, I should mention that the sample resident inclusion criteria, as I mentioned, was that on a continual basis they had to engage in negative emotional states and behaviors, and the highest level of those negative experiences at the residence. Now, it is important to emphasize that the 12 residents in the sample are a unique subgroup that does not represent the entire population of assisted living residents with dementia. Therefore, generalization of the study finding to the entire population of older adults with dementia in assisted living residences should be avoided, as it will be inaccurate and misleading. So what were the data collection strategies? The primary data collection strategy was unstructured direct observation or participant observation. And I also used a lot of informal conversations with staff and managers. I reviewed the clinical records and the behavioral logs on a daily basis and documented it. And at the end of the study, I conducted semi-structured interviews with staff and managers. The observations took place only in the public spaces of the unit. And by that, I mean I did not conduct observations inside the bedrooms or bathrooms. I spent 9.5 hours per day for over 200 days for a total of 2,000 hours. I should mention that beyond other characteristics of the assisted living that makes it considered to be providing high quality of dementia care, they had one of the unique services that they provided was extensive activity program. Very extensive and diverse activity programming until 8 p.m., not a minute earlier, in the evening. And they even let residents stay afterwards if they wish so. So I wanna give a kind of a short summary of the findings and the implications of the study. And then I thought we could address the rest of the questions that you had. I mean, is that reasonable, or you want to do it another way?
No, nope, let's do it your way. Go ahead.
Okay, so some of you read the article that Pamela shared with you. So I'm going to focus on a couple of main findings. So when unsupervised or left alone for significant periods of time, the sample residents, those 12 residents, experience a wide spectrum of negative emotional states and behavioral expressions. And of course, they didn't experience negative emotional states and behaviors all the time, but I think that a term that will characterize what they experienced, as I understood it, was that they really went through emotional roller coaster throughout the day, evening, and the night, I should add. So they became frustrated and restless and worried about different things, anxious. They appeared lost. They didn't know where, some of them didn't know where they are, where they're going, what they should do. Some of them became sad. And also they engaged in aggressive behaviors with other residents. They also engaged in behaviors that could be considered self-neglectful or institutional neglect. And these behaviors, I mean, you know, I'm just going to give a few examples. Mishandling feces in ways that seriously compromise one's hygiene. Risky behaviors that, such as eating non-edible items. One resident was putting during an activity, he put a metal smelling cup in his mouth. And luckily, recreation staff noticed it in time and prevented the resident from swallowing it or maybe choking on it. Other behaviors were insisting on eating extremely hot food, flooding a public bathroom and hallway, attempting to leave the unsecured unit unaccompanied. Some of those attempts were successful. So this was the first main finding in general. The second finding was possible protective effects of engagement in organized activities. And by that I mean that only a very small percentage of episodes of negative emotional states, various behavioral expressions and self-neglectful behaviors took place when the center residents were engaged in organized activities. I should mention that supportive one-on-one staff-to-resident interactions were also very important in preventing these negative experiences and in promoting positive emotional states in the center residents. For example, temple residents frequently engaged in high levels of negative emotional states and self-neglectful behavior. At the end of the article, you can see an observation excerpt of a pet therapy activity illustrating the positive and protective effect that engagement in personally meaningful activities had on this resident. Similar effects were repeatedly shown for other temple residents. At the same time, because I used unstructured direct observation, this finding needs to be interpreted with caution and replicated in future research using structured observation instruments. Now, moving into some of the practical implications. So the findings highlight the need for close supervision of a subgroup of vulnerable residents with dementia in assisted living residences. And the key here is systematic and ongoing assessment using a behavioral log is really, really key here and critical to be able to identify who those residents are and to inform targeted and individualized intervention to prevent those behaviors from occurring. In the words of Professor Ann Harley, as one would not leave toddlers alone or let them play with dangerous toys, at a certain stages of dementia, the care recipient should not be left alone. And take it from one of the residents in my study. He said one evening, I want to know that someone will be there for me if something would happen to me. Another practical implication is the need for to provide extensive, diverse, and high-quality activity programming. Now, state regulations of assisted living residences that operate dementia units, I believe, should require care providers to offer substantially higher number of organized activities per day than currently required in certain states. Now, there's probably variation across states in the requirements, and I didn't examine it nationally, but I do know that certain states require very, very limited number of activities, and this is a recipe for a lot of problems, as I will describe a little later. So what we need is cost-effectiveness studies to demonstrate the cost savings when enhanced activity programming is implemented. Now, if more studies in assisted living residences will confirm the existence of self-neglectful behaviors in assisted living residents with dementia, then the regulation should also explicitly address these behaviors and require care providers to state the measures that they take to address them in their policies and procedures. Now, just quickly going through Table 3 on page 142 and 143 in the article, I'm just going to touch quickly on other areas for intervention. So we know that in most nursing homes, there's understaffing. There's not enough staff on the floor to provide effective supervision, particularly for this vulnerable group of residents. So this should be a community-wide effort to assist director staff in supporting residents. And by that, I mean more presence of managers on the floor, more training and involvement of non-direct care staff members. And by that, I mean housekeeping, dietary staff, maintenance staff, front desk staff who sometimes walk into the unit, as well as recruitment of volunteers to assist in supervising the residents, as well as family members can also assist when they are visiting. And adding to that, assistive technologies should be the existing and others should be developed to assist staff in supervising residents. One example of such technology is called Visual Dementia System that can assist generate signals to staff in real time when, for example, residents enter other residents' rooms. And we know that this is a major trigger for altercation between residents, for example. But it could also indicate other problems that occur when residents are in their own room. This is just an example. We need to encourage companionship between residents. Some of the most compassionate acts occur between residents with dementia. Those in the earlier stages really advocate and help out to residents in the later stages because they know that tomorrow it's them. And of course, there's also the flip side. There's also negative interaction. But we can really harness the resources of the need of residents in the early stages to feel useful and to help others. One-on-one interactions are also crucial. Documentation and assessment is crucial, and I can talk more about ways to do it, for example, using a behavioral log. Another thing is that it's very important to use real case examples regularly to demonstrate to staff the clinical and preventative value of filling out the behavioral log. And really creating an atmosphere of learning as opposed to staff members who are concerned that if they're going to report behaviors, it's going to reflect on them, on their job performance negatively. Another thing that needs to be improved is information transfer between staff, director staff members, between different departments, whether it's director staff and recreation, and between staff and managers. This is crucial. Pertaining to negative emotional state and behavioral expressions. We need to continue and build what is called small-scale environment. When you have 8 to 10 residents, or maybe 12 or 14, like the greenhouse model, and there's up to 10 residents, and they're small enough, you know, eliminating the long hallways, which and creating a layout that increases staff ability to supervise residents. It increases the time that they have direct eye contact with residents. So that means that they are in a better position to identify early warning signs of distress and respond in time before the negative emotional state develops into behaviors, and then it's much harder to de-escalate them. And then there's other strategies in the table. And the last one that I'm going to mention here is knowing the history of behaviors in general, but self-neglectful behaviors, because many people with dementia in the community, when they live at home, before they move to assisted living and to nursing home, they engage in self-neglectful behaviors at home. So if we know it in advance, during the admission process, then we can inform intervention in the early stages of residency and prevent some of those behaviors from occurring. So I'm going to just a general overview of the study, some of the main findings, and some of the primary implications, if you will. So let me know if you want to continue with the other questions that you asked me. I have one question here with the boredom, or just let me know whatever you want me to continue addressing.
So let's just go through a few questions. So talk about, the article talked about boredom as being a basis for people being agitated. So what, talk about that, and then I want to know if people in the room have seen this.
Sure. So So you said that, you know, in the article, I cite studies, and we know from practice that boredom is a basis for negative emotional states and other behaviors. But you also mentioned that you heard that too much stimulation may result in the same. So first of all, you're absolutely right. The key is to identify for each resident what is the optimum level of personally adequate and meaningful stimulation. In other words, it is about finding and maintaining that delicate balance between understimulation and overstimulation for each individual. Now, like us, residents with dementia need to take a break, to rest, just to be, to reflect, and to recharge. So it is about developing an activity programming that has an adequate flow of activity throughout the day and evening with adequate periods of rest in between activities. Now, in order to know what the optimum is, interdisciplinary teams, and especially recreation staff, and when you have occupational therapists working at the residence, need to conduct ongoing high quality individualized assessment. And I say ongoing also because dementia is progressive usually, and therefore a moving target. I should add that overstimulation can manifest in different ways. One big source of overstimulation is the negative features in the physical environment, such as excessive noise, inadequate and low lighting levels, glare, environment that is cluttered or crowded, a hectic environment, and when simply there's too much going on and residents with dementia become overwhelmed in their response. According to the progressively lowered stress threshold model, as persons with dementia progress in their dementia, they become more sensitive to the physical environment. Another sources of overstimulation are inadequate and unskilled staff approaches and communication styles. Just to give an example, speaking too fast with the resident, using too long or complicated sentences, offering too many choices for residents, having too many items on the dining room table can overstimulate a resident. So things need to be simplified, and we need to minimize choices to maybe two or three options at most. Staff that are moving too fast or doing too fast hand gestures, and also requesting residents to do things that are beyond their cognitive ability. Now, overstimulation can also occur due to inadequate structured activities. Now, while engagement in meaningful activities is one of the best ways we have to reduce behaviors in this population and promote positive emotions, when activities are not suitable for the person's current abilities, disabilities, and preferences, they can certainly be perceived as negative stimulation and can often lead to anxiety and various forms of behavioral expression. And I want to make the distinction also between large groups and small groups. Some residents really struggle with large group activities, and they need small groups of activities that are not overwhelming for them. It also depends on the type of group activity, of course. As to your question, I don't know if you would like me to move to the next question or to address the question which is more prevalent, boredom or overstimulation.
Is there any questions for you? You know, I actually am going to jump because you talked about meaningful and stimulating activities. Which activities have you found to be the best? Just out of curiosity.
Okay. So let me just skip to that part.
I know I totally jumped, but you brought it up.
Do you know which number it is?
It probably isn't even a question that I sent you prior.
Here you go. I found it. Yeah. Number 7. Were there any activities proven to be more successful than others? For example, pet therapy or music therapy? While they may exist, I'm not aware of studies that compare the effects of different types of activities within the same sample of residents with dementia. That being said, I can say that the following activities can be very effective when they're delivered by a skilled group leader. So music therapy and music-based activities are extremely effective with this population. When, of course, the music is chosen based on the individual preferences of the resident, and many times it's old music from their young adulthood that works the best. Physical activities and exercise, art therapy can be very powerful. Aromatherapy and massage therapy can be very powerful. Therapeutic gardening, extremely powerful. Visiting with toddlers, pet therapy and animal or what is called animal assisted therapy is very, very effective when it's planned really well, carefully, and when it's monitored carefully during the actual activity. Creative outings to the community, such as visiting local museums. There's innovative programs such as Meet Me at the MoMA Alzheimer's Project that generates fabulous outcomes for this population. And reconnecting with nature, such as visiting botanical gardens, the zoo, and bird watching. Also, spiritual activities and religious activities are also crucially important and potentially effective. However, this is a highly individualized question. Each of us likes to engage in certain activities and dislikes others. Persons with dementia have their preferences, and while at a certain point of disease, they may not be able to tell you verbally what these preferences are. Close observation, a review of the person's life history, and conversation with a close family member will usually give you clues for tailoring activities that are meaningful to the individual. For example, some residents with dementia enjoy pet therapy activities, but others are simply not interested. And sometimes the best activities combine different modalities within the same activity. A good example is creative movement activity that was provided in my study, and I thought it was really terrific. And it combined movement, music, singing, dancing, gentle back and shoulder massage, guided imagery, elements of reminiscence, and even an intergenerational component. It was really powerful in bringing about positive emotions, and trust me, it dramatically reduced the level of anxiety and behaviors that would occur otherwise when residents are not engaged, those particular temporaries are not engaged in activities. Also, as I mentioned earlier, the exact same type of activity can be delivered in varying levels of quality, even in the same long-term care home, when led by a skilled and unskilled activity leader. The difference in effect can be striking. Now, if you have a question about this part, I'll be happy to try and address it. But you also asked me, I think, a very important question about human contact. So let me know when would you like me to address it.
Yeah, let's go to that one. Human contact, one-on-one touch. How important?
Okay. So how significant is the idea of human contact in preventing behaviors among older adults with behaviors? And I take it with residents with dementia, because this is the context of the study. Let me start by saying that close, trusting relationship with residents with dementia is the single most important asset we have when we interact with them, provide care to them, and in efforts to understand, prevent, and de-escalate various types of behavioral expression. This, along with knowing and using their life history, which is critical to building these relationships. There's also a strong relationship between events, major events and traumatic events that occurred early in life, and the nature of behaviors that occur in the here and now. But unfortunately, many times, because staff sometimes don't know the early life history of the resident, those behaviors are being taken out of context, and they're being attributed to the dementia, when actually they're giving us gifts. They're giving us clues to the origins of those behaviors and what we can do about them. Now, when care partners are able to build and maintain this cross-trusting relationship, they are in a much better position to understand, prevent, and de-escalate various behaviors. They are usually better able to gain resident cooperation. By contrast, when the quality of relationship is low or poor, and when there's lack of trust, staff face many more problems and have limited ability to prevent behaviors and gain resident cooperation. As we know, however, most CNAs are working in impossible, if not abusive, conditions that limit their ability to build and maintain these relationships. Care teams in most nursing homes are chronically understaffed, which limits their ability to provide residents with sufficient human contact beyond the physical contact that occurs during personal care time. Now, the late Professor Paul Lawton, a leading gerontologist, said, "A finding that begs for further investigation is that residents with dementia who interact more with others exhibited more pleasure, but also more anger." He asked, "Can a more careful study identify the specific interactions and combinations of people interaction type that are more associated with pleasure versus those resulting in anger?" Now, what is obvious is that dignified and skilled human contact can be very helpful in preventing behavioral expression, such as those that provide the residents with a sense of psychological comfort, a sense of security, companionship, and reassurance. On the other hand, undignified and unskilled human contact frequently leads and triggers different behavioral expressions. So it is a matter of the quality of the interaction and human contact. A classic example, which I'd like to discuss a bit further, is efforts to assist residents with bathing. One video-based study, and this is the gold standard for research in this population and with behaviors, analyzed the 5 seconds before assault by 18 residents with dementia during showers. The study identified nurse aid behaviors that occurred more often during the 5 seconds prior to assault. These included confrontational communication, invalidation of resident feelings, failure to prepare the resident for attack, disrespectful speech, and hurried pace. Interestingly, any touch was also identified as a trigger, but it was the initiation of touch, rather than the touch itself, that triggered the assault, possibly having a startling effect on the residents. And you can watch more examples of negative and positive responses by residents with dementia to unskilled versus skilled staff approaches and touch in the research-based DVD, Bathing Without a Bottle.
Yeah.
In general,
I watched that a couple of months ago. Yeah.
Oh, you did? Okay,
yeah.
Wonderful. And he also has, the book that I think is really critical that every nursing home and assisted living will, there's many, many resources and strategies and tips there that can really help create a more pleasurable bathing experience and a more effective and less resistant and rejection of care. Now, in general, I would like to say that in most nursing homes, most residents with dementia are deprived of sufficient supportive, skilled, and nurturing human contact. Many, though not all, feel lonely and are desperate for psychological comfort stemming from close trusting relationships and psychologically and physically warm human contact. One striking example is when you observe the transition, like in my study, for residents with dementia are anxious and distressed when they are bored or appear to be lost, when a group of toddlers or trained pets enter the unit and interact with them. These are the kind of interventions that we need to prescribe every day, as opposed to psychotropic medications that are mostly ineffective and have many serious adverse side effects. With regards to therapeutic touch, there are studies that show that reduction in certain behaviors in this population as a result of such touch. For example, a study by Wood from 2005 among a group of 57 residents with dementia in 3 special care units has shown that using intentional structured touch was linked with reduction of restlessness and disruptive vocalization. Now, I don't like the term disruptive vocalization, but this is what has been used in that study. And it's worth mentioning here the distinction between informal or unstructured touch, such as offering a resident a hug when seeing him or her in the hallway, versus structured planned touch.
And what is that, like massage or aromatherapy? I mean, what would you call structured touch?
So one definition of therapeutic touch is an intentionally directed process during which the practitioner uses the hand as the focus to facilitate a healing process. And as you mentioned, massage therapy, aromatherapy, when they are led by a professional skilled and trained individual, can be very powerful and calming individuals with dementia. There's studies that demonstrate it, and I've seen it many times in different long-term care residences. Now, I should emphasize that not every person with dementia likes to be touched, and some will respond negatively. Interestingly, as I noted earlier, some will respond negatively to certain staff members and then again positively to others. To a large extent, I believe it has to do with the quality of the relationship staff are able or unable to develop with residents.
And so the staff communities that you were working in, would you have called them highly trained, or how would you have defined them?
Well, I think that they provided a fairly large number of training sessions. They started with 14 hours. I'm talking about beyond the CNA training, or home health aid training. They provided 14 hours, but at the beginning of the study, and then 16 hours as a new regulation kicked in during the study. But only a small portion of those trainings were dedicated specifically to dementia, to communication strategies, to understanding and preventing behaviors, and understanding the role of the physical environment on behaviors, and the importance of teamwork. So I don't have data to compare across assisted living nationally. But I think they provided relatively high number of hours and fairly good quality of training. The problem is that there's a big difference between providing training in classroom, such as orientation training before the staff members start to work on the unit, and then you have the in-service training every month. A new topic on the pressing needs, that learning needs of the staff and the needs of the resident. But then you have what is called experiential learning. What happens, for example, during the evening hours when you barely have managers on the floor to provide supervision and support and guidance and role modeling to direct your staff who really struggle hours, and you have one nurse who is well-meaning and perhaps qualified, but she's floating between a few units, and she's unable to provide the supervision and guidance to staff when a lot of behaviors, a lot of anxiety occur in the evening hours. So we really need to make sure that we have that piece in place, the hands-on guidance when things happen on the floor.
So in the communities that you were in, do you think there were more behaviors in the evening hours versus during the day?
Well, I really can't say that because I used, as I mentioned earlier, unstructured direct observation. So what I mean by that, I didn't use an instrument that is structured. I used participant observation. So it wouldn't be, I cannot claim that. But what I do know is that there are temporal patterns throughout the day and evening at the individual level, resident, where when they tend to develop more anxiety and more behaviors. And as I mentioned earlier, one of those temporal patterns is when, at least with regards to the sample of residents in my study that are more vulnerable than the typical residents with dementia, when they're not engaged in activity. So there's a lot of downtime and boredom. And those are the time, and also when staff are busy providing personal care inside residents' rooms or apartments, there's windows in the morning that they're too busy inside rooms and they cannot supervise residents who are in the hallways, in the dining room, in the activity room, and a lot of anxiety and behaviors occur then. And so when during after mealtime, after lunch, staff are busy assisting residents with toileting. So they're not in a good position to provide that critical supervision. And then you have a lot of those negative experiences as well. But I can tell you definitively, I mean, there is the concept of sundowning, which, again, I think we should really move away from using that term. Usually used to describe increased anxiety and behavior in the afternoon and evening hours. But a study by Cohen Mansfield, who conducted the largest number of research studies on behaviors in dementia in the world, found that only one quarter of residents with dementia, or nursing home residents, experienced increased anxiety and behaviors in those hours. So we need to do a lot of work of changing perceptions out there. You know, once we say he's a sundowner, it's like a self-fulfilling prophecy. We start to expect the resident to experience those negative emotions and behaviors, and we almost create the conditions for those negative experiences to occur. And the reason why it's problematic is not only it puts a label on the resident, a sundowner or a wanderer, another problematic term, but most critically, when we call a resident sundowner, staff are less inclined to identify the unmet needs that most commonly underlie and drive the negative emotions and behaviors, including frustration, which many times when you look closely, you see that it's a situational frustration, which is actually encouraging because it means that it's potentially modifiable. I know it was a long answer, but...
And so is there any similarity or should there be special activity programs just for memory care only units versus general assisted living communities? And are there any laws about that, do we know? Do we have a state law about that?
Well, are you asking me if there's state law about that?
Yeah, so should there be, I mean, is there a benefit to having specific programs tailored to communities that only offer memory care versus all communities?
Okay, so first of all, we need to know that the majority of people with dementia in long-term care home, and by that I mean nursing homes and assisted living, among other settings, they live in what is called traditional units or mixed population units. When you have some people without dementia, and then you have people with different levels of dementia. And then you have what is called special care units or dementia units. When you have people with dementia and usually different levels of dementia. Now, both models can contribute to a lot of negative emotions and behaviors. For example, residents in the earlier stages not tolerating other residents in the later stages, et cetera. But to your question, activities should be tailored to the stage of the dementia. They should be first and foremost tailored to the needs, abilities, disabilities, and preferences of the person, each individual. But definitely there should be activities, even within dementia, activities that are provided to people with dementia in the earlier stages should be planned and designed and delivered in a different way. And the nature of the activity should be different than those provided to residents in the later stages of dementia as well. So on one hand, yes, in dementia units, you definitely want to have activities that are tailored to this population and to the level of dementia in which they are. And with regards to the traditional unit, I don't know if that's less of a straightforward question because you have the mixed population. And then the challenge is how do you provide differential activity programming for those with dementia, not to mention different stages of dementia, when they're actually living in the same space with residents who don't have dementia or have mild cognitive impairment.
Anybody have any questions? So how did the – so after you did the study, did any of these communities follow up with your recommendations, and did they see any changes?
So let me just get to that question. One second. Okay. I should just mention, I just want to take one step back for a minute and then address your question. I think it's important. I'm aware of at least four studies that demonstrated that nursing home residents, and many of whom we know, the majority have dementia, that studies that compared what is called downtime versus activity time. And these are really fabulous studies that show that a reduction of anxiety, restlessness, and other behaviors when the residents are engaged in meaningful activities versus when they are bored. And they're also substantially much more experiencing positive emotions during activities versus when they're not engaged in activities. One study in Japan by Schreiner demonstrated seven times more happy states, being in a happy state based on direct observation compared to when they were not engaged in activities. And why is this so important to be aware of those studies? And I can share those citations with you if you would be interested after the presentation. It's because we need to advocate for enhanced activity programming for this population. Some states provide require very limited level of activities. Some states require one activity per day. And this is outrageous because, as I mentioned, those people have led active and productive lives, and they want to continue and be useful even into their dementia. And providing only one activity per day is a recipe for a lot of problems, a lot of anxiety, a lot of negative emotions, behaviors, and safety issues. Now, going back to your question, so you asked me, were you able to follow up with the communities in the study to determine if the study results and recommendations were implemented? The short answer is no. At the same time, I did feedback the study results to the managers of the assisted living residence. I did so by giving a full presentation to the managers. I also gave them a copy of my dissertation. And if I recall correctly, I also gave them the executive summary of the study. However, shortly after the conclusion of the study, the CEO and a couple of other managers left to work in another long-term care home. So I'm not aware of the extent to which they were able to use some of the insights generated in the study. Maybe they did so in the new study, in the new care home they worked in. I did also meet with this new CEO separately and shared with her the findings of the study. Again, I don't know the extent to which they implemented them. I can only hope that they did. I also offered each of the family members of the 12 Temple residents an executive summary of the study results. If I recall correctly, nine of these families expressed an interest, and I sent them those executive summaries. I also offered a few families a specific report about their family member, about the findings, about their loved one. I even met with two families and walked them through these reports. Unfortunately, some of the Temple residents either deteriorated cognitively or functionally or moved to another care setting or passed away. So for some families, the reports were less relevant at that point. I also met with the Massachusetts Executive Office of Elder Affairs, who are in charge of the regulations in assisted living residences in the state, and gave them a copy of my dissertation. I also met and gave a copy of the dissertation to the local Alzheimer's Association.
Is there anything else you'd like to share?
Well, I could discuss, related issues, but I'm wondering if there's questions that folks would like to ask or comment or what I presented or think they're interested with regard to this population and behavior.
Anybody have anything? No, everybody's silent.
Everybody's silent. Okay. I hope everybody's awake.
Well, I'll ask one. So how do you balance risk management with staff providing some of these activities? Like I'm thinking in skilled nursing, if a CNA gives some sort of massage therapy and the resident ends up with skin tears or bruises or something like that, I know that's a concern for care communities who then have to report that and things like that. So do you have any suggestions for creatively bringing in some of these activities that are provided by people who are trained but are at a cost that a community that only accepts Medicaid, for example, might be able to accommodate?
So just so I want to see that I understand the question. So you're referring to certain activities, and you gave the example of massage therapy, and you're raising the concern about some risk or safety issues or skin tear or other skin-related problems, and you're wondering about ways in which this can be reconciled. Is that what you're asking?
Yeah. How do you mitigate some of those safety concerns in a cost-effective way, I guess?
Yeah, so first of all, as I mentioned, there are, in general, I have to say, as I mentioned earlier, that there are studies that show effectiveness of massage therapy and aromatherapy interventions, and I've seen it many times in practice. It's very powerful. I think that a critical thing that we need to take into account is that for too many decades, nursing homes and other long-term care homes are driven and they're operating based on custodial model of care, biomedical model of care, and fear-driven care. I think that fortunately, luckily, we have new models of care, such as the greenhouse models of the Eden Alternative and others, that one of their philosophies, if I understand it correctly, is that because we're so afraid of the regulation, nursing homes are monthly regulated, as opposed to assisted living that are minimally regulated, but there's campaigns to increase regulation. The problem is that staff are so concerned, managers are so concerned about liability issues and surveying, state survey inspectors' visits and compliance and deficiency reports, et cetera, that the care is driven too much by fear, and we're overprotecting the residents. Now, I'm not suggesting that we need to open all the doors of the secure unit or we need to ignore the skin problems that may occur in massage therapy or aromatherapy. But I think that we really need to see on the bottom what is the value of providing those extremely helpful activities versus the risk for safety and risk. And I believe that the benefit, by and large, and it's always an individual question that needs to be assessed at the individual resident level, are by far more helpful and beneficial to residents. And we have to remember that when we don't provide those activities, then there's a lot of behavior that trigger the vicious cycle of psychotropic medication that we know are very harmful, including adverse side effects and safety issues, and including the residents that die because of those medications. And I'm not suggesting that we shouldn't use those medications at all. Trying to go back to your question, I think that if the aromatherapy if the professional that leads the aromatherapy is well-trained, qualified, and there's a close collaboration with the nurse that is qualified and trained to assess the skin condition of the resident. And we have wonderful resources out there, including in the book, Bathing Without a Bottle. There's a whole chapter dedicated to skincare. So if you have that interdisciplinary collaboration and you reduce the fear and the overprotectiveness and you really see and you provide those activities, you can really see the beneficial effect. And you always have to pay attention to potential negative effects. And that's true also for pet therapy, and that's true also for toddler therapy. but they're really powerful means to engage residents, bring positive emotions, and dramatically reduce behaviors. And yes, when you put, you bring in toddlers into the activity room, I've never seen so many hugs, laughs, dancing, reaching out, reading from a book. This is what we need to prescribe. But as you imply, it has to be planned carefully, and we need to monitor it. We need to have enough staff around and involved in the activity to make sure that staff addresses any initial signs of distress of residents during the activity. But when all those components are in place, it can provide, can generate a profound positive effect. So on the balance, I think we have a strong incentive to provide those activities and doing it thoughtfully and carefully and always based on ongoing systematic assessment.
It'd be nice if Medicare and Medicaid would pay for those services like they do for the medication. But
I'm sorry, I can't hear. It's kind of an echoey.
It's difficult because, you know, Medicare and Medicaid won't pay for aromatherapy or massage necessarily, but they will pay for the psych meds. And I know with, you know, cost concerns, it's difficult sometimes to work those services.
Right, so as we all know, there's a national campaign by Centers for Medicare and Medicaid to reduce psychotropic medications in nursing homes, and most of the residents have dementia. And because of the research that shows negative effects for most residents, or ineffectiveness, I should say, for most residents, a lot of side effects. And they're extremely costly. Behaviors are very costly. And what we should do is to advocate for psychosocial, person-centered, person-directed approaches and interventions. Center for Medicare and Medicaid should fund at the same level, I should say much more, psychosocial interventions and therapies and activities much more than any medication that is available out there. And it's a slow process, it's a journey, but I think this realization is starting to sink in. But it may take years until we get to the point where what is called non-pharmacological strategies are being funded the majority of the funding should go to those interventions. So this is where it's heading, I hope, and to do that, we need to do that advocacy work to get there. And you also meant cost implications. I mean, behaviors and dementia have huge cost implications. There's the issues with staff turnover, there's injuries to staff who many times try to intervene and take the fire. You have absence from work, you have medical care, you have residents who are injured, and you have falls, you have hospitalizations that are extremely expensive, psychotropic medications that's extremely expensive. There's costs for family members who are called into the residence to help out with the behavior of the resident, and they have to leave work. There's many cost implications that we need to make sure that the public is aware and policymakers are aware in order to drive policy towards psychosocial intervention, person-centered intervention, and person-directed intervention, and less so psychotropic medication-based intervention.
Thank you. Thank you so much for your time.
Well, thank you for the opportunity to speak with you, and hope it was useful. And let me know if you have more questions. I'm always available in email. And thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Take care.